This is the Education Gadfly Show.
It's hard to lie, you know. There's
some people,
a thousand people who could tell me a different
name
story.
Names.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our special guest for this week, the founder and CEO of KIPDC, Susan Schaeffler. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's exciting to be here.
Yeah. Well, we're excited to have you. Also joining us, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike.
Hello, David. David, who taught in a DC charter school.
Very briefly.
It was not a KIPP school.
Okay.
And it was not a quality charter school.
I think that's fair.
We have a long history of only hiring people that taught in terrible charter schools.
Yes. You know what?
To give a particular perspective
we're hiring,
on these
we
things.
We are hiring, keep your options open.
Hands off. Well, Susan, so excited to have you here. I've been a huge fan of what you've done here in D.C. With KIPP. Of course, we're big fans of KIPP everywhere. We are an authorizer of the KIPP Columbus School in Ohio, and so we get to see that up close. Before we get into some of this stuff we're going to talk about today around teachers, just remind us about the scale that we're talking about in D.C. How many kids? How many schools?
Well, we started with just 80 kids about 17 years ago. We now have 6,200. They attend schools at six different campuses, which house 17 schools. So it's 16 schools, and we have a learning center as well.
Yeah.
You know, we've had a lot of growth.
Yeah.
In a short amount of time. But the need and the demand is there. So, you know, our intent is to keep trying to fill that need.
And it's pre-K through 12.
Pre-K three, all the way through grade 12.
Yeah.
Our next project is to work with Somerset Academy.
Yeah.
And work with that team to open up a second high school.
Okay.
So our intent is really to have two high schools that are, you know, located in the city, one on the east side and one on the west side of the river, to make sure that we can meet the needs of all of our students.
Very, very cool. You know, it's sometimes it feels like in education, like nothing works or we've never made progress. And yet, you know, here we are with KIPP and some of these other high performing charter networks that are getting to significant scale and continue to get incredible results. All right. Well, let's talk about your strategies around teacher preparation and recruitment and retention and all of that, which is a challenge for schools nationwide right now in Ed Reform Update. Okay, so Susan, we see in Ohio, and I think folks see around the country, that it is really hard to find great teachers right now. That's the same for any school, public, private, charter. You know, it's a tight labor market. And when this happens, we see fewer people going into teaching. Everybody's having a hard time finding talent right now. But here in DC, you're up against a public school system that's paying a lot of money for teachers after the reforms that Michelle Rhee had in place, six figures in some cases.
Yep.
So we certainly hear that is a particular challenge for charters. You know, you've got a lot of money in DC charters, but not that much money.
Right.
Tell us how you're dealing with this challenge.
Well, you know, I think there's a few different strategies that we tried to sort of create over time. And I think when you say, you know, I do think KIPP is doing a lot of things right in the District of Columbia, but we make mistakes. And what we're able to do is correct them quickly. We're flexible. We're nimble. We're able to say, what do we want to do? What do we need to do? What's not working? What's working? And we kind of have that conversations with ourselves every day. And so it's not that, and I think that's sometimes where other systems get stuck, is they keep doing the same thing over and over again. And when it comes to teacher talent, there's nothing different in that concept either, except we want to make sure that we're constantly figuring out, what are the pipelines? Where are teachers coming from? Are they coming out of Teach for America? Are they coming out of ed schools? Mm-hmm. Are they coming out of the workforce, out of a different career? And how can we capture as many, how big of a net can we toss, and how many people can we pull into our system?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we really had our major growth, we said, you know, our biggest weakness right now is, how do we keep up with the human resource piece of our growth? And that was when we started the Capital Teaching Residency. And basically, it's a teacher training program where you get to come in either right out of college, maybe a career changer, maybe you're coming from the military, and you get to spend a year with our top talent.
Mm-hmm.
And you are the second teacher in that classroom for an entire year.
Yeah.
So we're really, the sink or swim strategy is one strategy that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And this is a little bit more kid friendly, if you will. So we're not rolling the dice on someone and being like, hope it works. You know, here's your class. We actually get to learn the CTR gets to learn from a lead teacher who is an expert in their field and a current expert. So they're learning what is on the park assessment, what are the new trends around student management and, you know, a culturally aware climate, and how are we doing everything from books that we're using that are inclusive, that are sensitive to the students that we serve, to how we're managing students, how we're setting the schedule, how we're doing the curriculum. Those things are always changing in a charter school. And that's why we want to make sure that teachers are getting trained really on the job with our best talent.
And to pick your best talent to do this. I mean, this has always been a challenge for student teaching in traditional settings, right? It's often felt like it's been like whoever would take the candidate. And so you don't necessarily get to see somebody.
Well, when you know
you're knocking it out of the park.
When you're training your next colleague, when you know that the teacher that's in your classroom learning how to teach is going to be the classroom teacher next to you next year, you're hugely invested in that person being successful. Yeah. So it's slightly different from the model where you go to a school, you're there for 4 weeks, and then you're gone. Maybe you never go back to that location. We hire almost all of our CTRs, and the ones that we don't, we share with DC Public Schools and other charter schools.
Yeah.
So not only, we're training about 100 teachers a year for the city, which is great.
It sounds expensive.
Well, you know, there's a few strategies to help cut costs. One is we've reduced the number of teaching assistants. So wherever there is already two teachers in a classroom, we replace that salary with a capital teaching resident. So, and in some cases, we keep teachers' assistants because they bring a lot to the table too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one area where we were able to sort of reallocate resources and, you know, sort of catch a teacher who is new to the profession and learning how to become, you know, learning their craft at the beginning of their career, that stays with us for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. That is when it really starts to work. And it is expensive. We do fundraise for it, but so is recruiting teachers endlessly. And when you become a CTR, you train for a year, you commit for two more after that. If you want to stay and work on your master's degree in special education, that's another certification that we offer, because really all teachers could benefit from having a certification in special education as well. So those are the sort of the things that we've been doing to make sure that our teachers are trained, are supported, and really want to stay.
Yeah.
You know, successful teachers stay.
Yeah.
Happy teachers stay. And the job is so hard. It is so hard.
Are you upfront about that? I mean,
yes.
Because I always have a hard time. I mean, obviously we need great teachers. Right. And it's so hard when someone is thinking about it, you want to be honest with them. It is a hard job. But I feel like when we talk about that, in some ways, we're contributing to the problem of retention. Yeah. And I mean, but I guess people are going to burn out anyway.
Well, I feel like in the early days of, you know, TNTP figured out with their marketing for the teaching fellows, you know, 20 years ago, that the campaigns that worked best were the ones that did say up front, this is really hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of that, you know, the toughest job you'll ever love kind of marketing, rather than sugarcoating it, you know, and saying this, you know, and then we want people who are up for this challenge. I mean, if you're not tough and resilient, you're not going to last.
Right. And I mean, you're a CEO of your own classroom, and you run that classroom with 30 children or teens, or 3-year-olds. Mm. And that people who like to work hard and be in charge thrive in that environment. It is actually, for some folks, it is the only thing that they want to do their entire life. And those are my favorite folks. Some people want to do it for a few years and get into administration. Some people want to do this until they have, you know, a personal, you know, something that is taking them outside of the classroom. They can't do the long hours. The reason why teaching is so hard is there's just a lack of flexibility in the profession. So you can't check your phone. You're not going to go to the bathroom when you want to. I mean, you literally are down to, you know, this class ends at 2:36 and you can't be late. You got to be on time and you got to be on. You've got to be on. The energy's there. The kids need you to be great every day. And we want to have principals that are supporting our teachers in that. Our principals are coming from our classrooms. That is also very appealing, I think, to many of our classroom teachers is they look at their principal and say, I know you've taught this class before. I know you can come in and help me.
Yeah,
our principals are instructional leaders.
Susan, you know, the stereotype of charter schools, and probably KIPP over the years, has been that, okay, you get all these young teachers in and you work them crazy hard and they burn out after a few years and then you get a new group. I mean, is that still,
you know, there's accurate? Some truth to that. And I, you know, I can't say that, you know, everybody stays for as long as I have.
Can I just say your honesty is refreshing?
Well, it's hard to lie. You know, there's
some people,
a thousand people who could tell me
I'm
a different
name
story.
Names.
It is hard, and we do try to do things like, what can we do around, you know, and the balance of families? And that's what gets really tricky, is when you have your own kids and you go from a 20-something to a 30-something, and those are big transitions. So we've tried to build some things in around wellness days where we have where it's a day where the students don't come. It's a half a day of professional development and a half a day to get your eyes checked, get your Jiffy Lube done, whatever you need to get done, really your own personal time, go climb in bed, whatever. And we've built those in. We've tried to be strategic about calendaring so that the teachers are getting the breaks when they need them throughout the year. At the same time, we always put kids first. So if it's not best for kids, then we got to go back to the drawing board until we can make it work. And and that's a balance. And it's true.
And it does sound like, look, there's some middle ground between saying that, you know, almost every teacher is going to teach for 30 years, which maybe happened in the past. I mean, I'm not so sure about
that. And I'm not even sure that's...
But real downsides to that, right? Yeah. Or just, you know, we're going to have nothing but 22-year-olds in the last couple of years. I mean, there's this, and the middle ground to me looks a lot like the military, right? Yeah. Which is that, yes, there are some people who come and only stay for their initial commitment, but other people, you know, make a career out of it. And it tends to be an up or out kind of situation, that if you're, you know, you're not going to stay and do the exact same job for 20 years, but if you continue to grow in your skills, you're going to get promoted and new opportunities, and you're going to get to take on those challenges and figuring out how to do that, you know, which is not to say that you have to leave the classroom, but that there's new roles that allow you.
Right. And remember, once you become a really great fifth grade teacher, then you do that year after year after year after year. And I really think what we try to do at KIPP DC is, how do we put new, fresh challenges in front of her? It's challenging enough, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it fun? How do you make sure the staff is working well together? How do you make sure that the fifth grade teacher at one middle school gets to connect with the fifth grade teacher at the other middle school teaching the same subject? Mm-hmm. So bringing the staff together. And a diverse staff is our best staff. Mm-hmm. So, and that's diversity on all fronts. Yeah. So not just on race and religion and gender preference, all of those things, but also on, you know, how many years have you been teaching? Were you a TFAer or did you go to ed school? Like all of those backgrounds bring to the table a different lens, a different perspective that makes us stronger as a group. So I think that's what, you know, you don't want a whole staff of 50-year-olds. You also don't want a whole staff of 25-year-olds.
Yeah.
You want a nice blend and a nice mix because everybody's bringing something to the table. The kids are needy and we want to make sure that we're meeting all of their needs.
What's the biggest unaddressed challenge? I know we're running out of time, but I mean, what would help most? Is it just the money thing? Competitive salaries?
It's not the money. I always say it's the money because we can always do more with more. But the reality of it is, it's actually the profession in itself is just it's a hard job. Yeah. You can't, and so we're competing with people. We're like, I can telecommute one day a week, or I can do this one day a week, or can I have some flexibility to leave? And the reality is teaching is a hands-on job. It is person to person. It is not something you can do over the phone via, you know, some sort of, we're trying to leverage technology. We're trying to make sure where there are opportunities to be innovative. But
can't
at the end,
compete on that margin,
the flexible workplace.
That's a killer.
Not apply that, to
teaching. It is really hard. Yeah. And for KIPP DC and for every charter, but every traditional school as well, as our country is like, hey, we can, you know, spend more time at home or less time commuting. That's really hard for us. Mm-hmm. So we're like, hey, we need you here every day. Feeling 110%, that's a big ask. So anything I can do to make that easier, beneficial. And the thing is the biggest reward for our teachers in many ways is just being successful. Yeah. And successful teachers thrive and their kids thrive. And then the system thrives and the schools thrive and then our communities thrive. And that is really what we're going for. And it's no easy task, but it's not unique to us, the flexibility piece. Yeah. But that is something that we're all struggling with. And that online stuff is, it's not a slam dunk. But we're all kind of tinkering with how do you leverage technology to maybe provide some relief in that area. But that human contact's for real.
Yeah.
And that's what makes kids grow and develop into folks who can, you know, have choice-filled lives, which is what we're going for.
I love it. We will leave it there, Susan. So inspiring and exciting to hear what you're up to. I hope you come back sometime soon. Again, Susan Schaeffler, the CEO of KIPP DC. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Such a great talk with Susan. Very impressive, huh? Yeah. I mean, a leader who just, you know, is running something that works and but keeps at it, keeps improving it. And I understand is going to be taking over a school that you're on the board of.
They are. And it was good. It was the best decision for our kids.
Yeah.
And so we're excited about it. And the transition has gone really well. It's been very smooth thus far.
Does this mean the board disbands?
I'm boardless.
Amber, you slacker.
I tried. I was on the academic committee, which, I mean, it's tough. It's a tough job. We all know when you're in a real school trying to do real things and not just talking about them.
It is hard. And yes, we tried to do that here at Fordham is to get into the details and the mess that is reality in the real world. All right. But enough about that. Into the hypothetical world of research.
All right. We've got a new study in AERA Open that examines how text messages to parents of pre-K students could impact their child's literacy development. Mm-hmm. There's so many of these studies now, right? But anyway,
do they text the kids and do they help their parents?
Okay, yes. All right. The parents. We know there's growing interest in these low-cost, you know, tech-based, you know, interventions to support parental involvement to try to get the kids, you know, boosting their academic success. And they make the case that preschool is critical period because that's when you're really wanting your kid to get ready for elementary school. It's a small-scale randomized control trial. Occurred in a single suburban school district in a mid-Atlantic state that prioritized pre-K enrollment for children deemed at risk. That's all the information we got on this district. In that case,
sounds a little bit like my home district in Montgomery County, but okay, I'm not sure if it is.
It means that children had a family income at or below 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, were homeless, or their parents had dropped out. So those are some of the criteria, not all, under which this district was enrolling these pre-K kids. The sample included 177 parents and their four-year-old children in 13 pre-K classrooms across 7 schools. Within each classroom, half of the parents were randomly assigned to one of 2 conditions. The first one, the treatment condition included actionable text messages, because other stuff is found that you got to give them an action, right? You just can't give them information. Using the child's name and focused on language and literacy, asking parents, for instance, to tell stories, discuss books, do rhyming activities, and so on. For instance, regarding sounds, parents got the text message, ask Joseph to close his eyes, knock on a table, and say, can you guess what makes that sound? Then try different sounds. An example of a message. The treatment group received messages unrelated to literacy and instead around well-being, including text about nutrition, sleep habits, safety, behavior, transitions, and self-confidence, among other things. For example, one text in the comparison group read, set a good example by serving healthy food that you like or eating something new so that Tamara sees you enjoying what you are asking her to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The program lasted 25 weeks for both the treatment and comparison groups, and both received name customized messages 3 times a week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, along with a 4th message every week that asked parents whether they had time to do the activities. There were no differences between the 2 groups in terms of the number of parents responding to the messages or the level of reported engagement with the text content.
Okay.
That's key. Overall, message response rates per week range from 35 to 58%. Finally, the kids' literacy skills were measured using a battery of instruments per usual classroom practices prior to and after the intervention. Whew. The results for four of the eight literacy measures, including rhyming, early writing, and alphabet knowledge, the comparison group, those parents who didn't receive the literacy text, had better literacy outcomes.
Ooh, right.
Interesting.
Demonstrating small to medium effects. That was not what they expected.
No, it's not.
So next, they tested whether the effects varied by children's pre-test scores and found an interesting interaction. In all cases, they found that children with relatively higher fall test scores tended to perform better in the treatment condition, with the literacy test, whereas those with lower fall test scores tended to perform better in the comparison condition with the well-being test.
Hmm.
But then they spend a while hypothesizing why that might have happened. And they posit that perhaps the well-being messages may have been better matched to the needs of kids in the lower end of the skill distribution,
mm-hmm.
especially if they struggled with attention or behavior issues, which the text and presumably their parents subsequently addressed.
Huh.
Similarly, the literacy text may have been better matched to the kids entering pre-K in the upper end of the distribution and unintentionally geared toward more skilled children. But the bottom line is that the parents and the kids responded differently to the two conditions based on the child's initial skill levels. And I thought, this is good to know, right? Because we keep coming up with these sort of low-cost, like, you know, mm-hmm. interventions. And to date, we really haven't cracked the code on how to customize them and how mm-hmm. to get smarter about how to customize them. So I thought it was a very useful study, even though it was small scale.
So, but then what? So that means that you should send the kids who scored lower on the initial test their parents' texts about well-being?
Well, I mean...
And the literacy texts to kids who did... better on the literacy test?
Honestly, what do we think's happening here, right? Like, we can't get the black box about, like, how this happened, right?
Well, by the way, if they would just turn on the cell phone and listen in, then they could find out what exactly was happening. Come on. We've got these phones. We can just listen in on the parents the whole time.
I'm Alexa.
Sort of kidding. But
sort of kidding.
That's actually my first question. How did they get all these cell phone numbers? I mean,
yeah. I mean, they got the information from the school. And you guys, this was not in the study. But yeah, I do know that the teachers didn't know which kids were in the treatment and control condition and parents, because that was key.
They did not.
They did not know.
Okay, it was blind.
Right, it was blind. And so, anyway.
It's interesting. I mean, look, I would have guessed that they just would find no effect, because it just feels like, you know... Do these a little bit of a nudge? Is it a big enough of an intervention to really change behaviors?
Sort of actionable, right? I mean, they were actionable.
Oh, I mean, I'm just like, really? Are we sure this was not just a random result? But it sounds like they're.
I mean, it's
quite
a small.
Sure.
It's a small scale trial. I mean, that's why I made a point to tell you that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's not huge,
but it was very unlikely that these results were just by random chance.
I don't think so. Not in the way. I mean, they did it at the classroom level too, David. Right. So that mm-hmm. presumably controls for a lot of things you'd be worried about.
Yeah.
Within the classroom.
Interesting. Yeah.
David looks perplexed.
Yeah. I am a little perplexed. Yeah. What's the takeaway?
It's 1 year.
Sure.
I mean, and let's just be careful. It's over 1 year, yeah. right? Like, it's a small. Some of these interventions aren't huge.
Yeah,
no, it's not, it's you know, I put a point in there. It's small to moderate effect. It wasn't like these huge differences.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something here. I mean, let's look at it in the larger literature of these interventions that we're seeing, you know, yeah. that consistently show some promising effects.
So,
right?
So hang on. So there wasn't a true comparison group, like someone.
That's exactly right.
All right.
That's exactly right.
I mean, I guess that's what's strange.
Because they went in, right? They went in thinking mm-hmm. they couldn't just give the comparison group business as usual. Right. I mean, other studies
for ethical reasons or for.
I think they thought that it wouldn't be business as usual is not exactly the right comparison group. But you're right. They went in thinking that they had to, if it was a literacy intervention that they were mm-hmm. testing, that they still need to give the comparison group messages about something.
Yeah.
Right. On the same scale, on the same frequency and all that thing.
Mm-hmm. I guess so. I guess my point is, I don't know, we don't really know that either maybe they both worked, right?
Well, they clearly did for different types of kids. I mean,
yeah. or maybe not. Maybe they both worked terribly, right? I mean, isn't the comparison just relative to the...
Yeah, to the other one.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe they both destroyed kids and one just did it a little bit more on one thing than the other. I guess I'm just saying, without a real comparison group, how do we know?
Yeah.
Am I missing something?
I mean, I don't know if they would destroy... I mean, the responses on these... on the test are still increasing. I mean, I guess I'm a little confused as to why. I mean, we didn't see incredibly negative effects, right, for either group on these tests.
Relative to whom? To other kids?
Relative to the other group. That's right. Relative to the other group.
But you're right. It is relative. And we don't know what happened to kids who didn't get text messages.
You don't have some placebo kind of condition.
And look, maybe, I mean, the practical response is, well, we should be sending texts about both literacy and wellness, you know.
Right.
Because
that's right.
Those wellness messages might have been important to these kids. Of course, we talk about in pre-K, we don't just care about academic development,
right.
but all this
other
kind of
development. I do think they went in thinking, I mean, this was clearly a surprise to them. I think they went in thinking that they weren't obviously not going to find this, right? That it was just testing this one intervention around literacy and not
Yeah, and, I guess I always just want one mm-hmm. group that nothing happened to, so I can yeah. see.
No, I yeah. would be curious. I mean, look, you do wonder from a parent's perspective, you know, there's the specific instructions, which, you know, some parents might be like, oh, that's kind of a cool idea. I'll try that. The other thing might just be, it's almost a mindfulness thing. You know, it's like three times a week, you're getting this reminder mm-hmm. to be thoughtful about your parenting mm-hmm. and to try to live up to some ideal.
Right.
And be like, all right, that's right. I really should be reading my kids more, or I should right. be eating better, or I don't know. And that itself might, yeah. might be helpful, because, you know, especially parents of young kids, man, I feel for you. I've been there. You're stressed, you're exhausted, and you are rarely living up to the ideals that you would like to in terms right. of what's what good right. parenting looks like.
This is sort of a weird segue, but I used to work in political campaigns, and it is this is amazing effect, you know, where you're on a campaign and you start sort of advertising, right? Mm-hmm. And you will see that people respond. Right. And that actually very, I mean, there's a reason we have advertisements, basically. It's, yeah. It's sort of hard to believe. And I mean, I know this isn't pitched as an advertisement, but I guess I buy the notion, right? That like, I think we can sometimes underestimate the degree to which, attention and reinforcement mm-hmm. matter, even mm-hmm. among adults. We all think of ourselves yeah. as rational actors, yeah. but yet, you know, I don't know if I'm going to vote for so-and-so because I'd raise some questions. Right. And conversely, I mean, I do think, you know, the right messages, assuming I think that's maybe my takeaway is like, I don't know, they're good political ads and bad political ads. And I'm quite confident that there are totally ineffective or effective text messages, too. So I guess I just want to know,
yeah.
right, like, what is right. the exact message that parents need to hear? Like, have we nailed that down? I don't know.
I guess, you guys are being a little harder on this study than I think you should be. Like, I think these were not terrible things we're asking parents to do, to Mike's point.
Yeah.
I don't see how they could have hurt kids by asking them to, you know, read your kid, give them a sound, but, you know.
I'm sure they didn't hurt kids. So, I was just making a point.
And the third, and sure, it would have been great if we had another treatment group, right? Because you see a lot of studies do that. They have two treatment conditions compared then, to, stat, you know, business as usual.
That's what David, he's just greedy. That's
he wants cool. another group.
All right. Hey, guys, we are way over time here.
Oh, we are.
Sorry. That is all the time we've got for this week. We'll have more nudge studies in the future.
We will.
Until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.